Nice. Welcome to the February 26, 24, 2024 Finance and Administration Committee meeting, and it will now begin. First item on the agenda is our Pledge of Allegiance. Please stand with me. Over your heart and repeat with me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. First off, we have some announcements that we will talk about a little bit here on the procedures of tonight's meeting. The meeting is being conducted in person at the SCB Water Engineering Service Section Boardroom as a convenience. Members of the public may also participate virtually by listening and/or making comments to the committee by using the call-in number or the Zoom webinar link provided in the packet. In the event there is a disruption of phone or internet service, which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, this meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote participation. The remote participation option is being provided as a convenience to the public and not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. We have public present. Therefore, public comment cards are located on the table outside the boardroom. Please complete and return to Erica Dale, to my left, to help expedite your comments. The procedures for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present. I will ask for public comments. I will then ask for discussion or questions from the committee members. Presently, we have one committee member here, Kathy Albertage, board member, and myself, Ken Peterson, board member. And we expect others being Maria Gutsight, Vice President Gutsight, to arrive shortly. With that, do we have any item number two? Do we have any public comments?
Not at this time.
Good, thank you.
Neither do I.
None.
Not online either.
None online either. Thank you. I have to get my lips. So with that, we'll move on to item. What we'll do because of Vice President Gutsight not being here, we're going to talk about item number nine, which is just a presentation by Jesus Martinez Ramirez, our fleet and warehouse update for the night. So with that, Rochelle, you want to start Jesus or?
Yes, is Jesus online?
He's not, but Kim is.
Kim is.
Jesus is having trouble logging in. His Zoom is having a little bit of an issue, he just said. So I can just give a quick update to introduce Matt from Terra Verde. He will be presenting. Hi, Matt. He will be presenting an update on our infrastructure that we had asked them to do. So I'll hand it over to you, Matt.
Sorry about that. I was muted. So we do have some slides to accompany this. I talked with Jesus a bit earlier, understood they'd be shared on that end if we're prepared for that.
We are pulling it up now.
Okay, great.
Presentation, since we weren't sure what time you were.
Okay.
I'll let you know when I see him on my end. There they are. Great. Okay. Well, to Kim's point, we are focused on the infrastructure associated with the anticipated zero emission vehicles that will be likely will be purchased over the next 10-year period, and that's what we'll cover here. Matt Zarega from Terra Verde Energy joined Terra Verde Energy about a year ago. I've been focused in this domain almost exclusively for the last 15 years. That is being electric vehicles, electric vehicle infrastructure, and that's what I handle for Terra Verde is that same domain. So Kim and Jesus and I'm sorry if I don't remember the other folks' names, but have been very good to cooperate with in developing a plan for the infrastructure associated with these ZEV purchases in response to the Advanced Clean Fleet regulation. So that's what we'll cover. So if we can go to the next slide here. So, as I just stated, this is all focused on Advanced Clean Fleet regulation, which I think the notable thing there is that what we're talking about is medium and heavy duty vehicles, not the light duty. And that's basically everything from over 8,500 pounds on road, not non-road. So we can move on here to the next slide. So as many of you may know, there's two options in the ACF regulation. There's one that appears best in terms of options for compliance. That's what this reflects, which is the what's known as the default option for compliance, which essentially says that you will replace a certain percentage of your vehicles each time you decide to purchase vehicles with target percentages by year. So between now and 2027, 50% of the vehicles that you would purchase need to be zero emission. And that's what's reflected we see here in the 24 to 26 column. The 27 column is that 50%. So in 24 to 26, there would only be one vehicle that was zero emission to be purchased, which is reflective of two vehicles that appear to be ready for retirement in that time frame. And then from 27 onward, all purchases would need to be zero emission. So we see the one in 2028 and then onward over to the total over that time period, which is 12, which gets us to the topic of this discussion, which is 12 pieces of charging infrastructure to support those vehicles over the next 10 years. And then there's a second note there that says beyond that time frame, it does appear that in that medium heavy duty category, there's 16 additional vehicles that would anticipated that we would anticipate would be purchased in addition. Can we move to the next slide, please? Thank you. Okay, so that moves us to the infrastructure for those 12 vehicles. As we can see there in that simple table, on the left, we see the charger rating, which is a function of two things: the voltages that we typically see on commercial industrial sites, which is either 480 or 208 generally, and the amperage rating for that charging infrastructure. And what we see based on the drive cycles and the specific weights of the trucks and the speeds that they're driven, that sort of thing, and the durations that they're parked between drive cycles, we would need this collection of infrastructure here. So 154 kW unit, the 115 kW unit, 133 kW unit, 517 kW units, the 313 kW, and the 16.7 kW unit, which is kind of a de facto standard charging unit that would typically be used on light duty. I think the thing to highlight here is that these power ratings are selected based on the minimum charge rate that you would need to comfortably ensure that these vehicles are prepared at the end of a drive cycle for the next drive cycle during that parking duration, with a little bit of a buffer in there to for that assurance that it will be ready. And for those 12 charging units at the sites that we'll look at here in a moment, we would expect, roughly speaking, for a rough order of magnitude estimate, about $670,000 for that infrastructure fully installed. And we can move to the next slide. So this is Rio Vista here. And this is a busy slide. So let me just go over a few things really quick. What we're showing here is, among other things, is existing transformers, existing service panels, and parking areas where these vehicles will be, where we would expect that they will be parked. This icon here is an existing charging unit that's already in place, which I understand was a 4-Pro charging unit installed during the time of purchase of some existing electric vehicles that you have. But I think the thing to a couple of things to note about this here when we look at this site is there's a lot of complexity here in terms of hardscape, landscape, existing buildings. So to accurately estimate infrastructure costs here is a bit challenging. And I think what we've accommodated in our estimate is sort of contingency for that complexity. But generally speaking, what you want to do on this site and on any site is, since we have some choices here about these locations, is to try to place these things, these parking areas and charging units near the existing infrastructure. Any questions so far?
Well, answer questions after your presentation.
Okay, very good. All right, let's move to the next slide. Okay, Pine Street. So Pine Street has its own challenges. We see here that from the list that we looked at earlier of charging equipment, we see that the power levels and the counts. The challenges that are unique to this site is this creek area here. And I understand that some of these oak trees are protected, if not all of them. So if this area here is to be developed into a parking area, those oak trees may present a challenge. But there are some other areas to choose from. Each of these have sort of their own challenges. We look here at this transformer, we see we'd have to cross the creek to get over here to get the conductors over here to this parking area, for instance. But yeah, I think that's all to point out here for Pine Street. Yeah, let's move to the next slide, please. Okay. GT, plenty of options here for parking areas. This appears to be particularly appealing for proximity to existing service, existing transformer. In developing this site, you would follow the same sort of general criteria for keeping the cost down. Just pick the areas that are closest to existing service. And the other thing I think I'd note here is, given the density of this parking, and considering that only two charging units in theory would be needed, and these are high power units, they should be spaced as far apart as possible to allow those cords off of these charging units to reach as many vehicles as possible without having to move the vehicles. Next slide, please. Okay, incentives to cover some of this capital cost for the vehicles, for the infrastructure are noted here. Probably the most well-known program that's been out there for the longest is this HVIP program, which provides vouchers for the vehicle purchases, generally processed through the dealerships. And it in general, across vehicles, these voucher amounts bring the cost near parity with conventional vehicles, or at least that's the intent. For the infrastructure, Southern California Edison's Charge Ready Transport program should cover up to 80% of the actual or the total cost installed for the equipment. And there are a couple of different options for this. Some of them are associated with easements, and it's important to understand the implications of those easements before making particular decisions about program offerings through SCE, but they should cover the majority of the capital outlay. And then the CVRP is mentioned here. Two, despite the fact that it doesn't cover the medium and heavy duty vehicles that are subject to the ACF regulation, it's for light duty, but it is our understanding that there are plans internally, or at least discussions internally, about also electrifying the light duty fleet. So we mentioned that here because that may provide you some additional advantage. And we move to the next slide, please. Okay, so as far as infrastructure planning and next steps, these three are the most important, which is just to commence that infrastructure planning as soon as possible, so that this typical 18-month time frame for infrastructure projects will, if you start now, you'll have enough time prior to the deployment of your first ZEV. So that's pretty important. You want to get ahead of that 18-month timeline. And then the most immediate need is to submit the initial compliance report to CARB, which really is just some simple information about the district, and then a list, basically a list of, and attributes for each vehicle within the fleet that is subject to the regulation, and to get that submitted through what they call the trucker system. So it's a pretty straightforward process. And then to evaluate and select the first ZEV. And next slide. Okay.
That's okay.
So questions?
Do we have any public comment?
No, I'll leave that up to you right now. No public comment online.
Right. Any comments from the board? Members, go ahead.
I have a couple questions. Go ahead.
For questions.
Okay, a couple of quick questions. And I apologize if I missed, I don't think I missed the beginning, but the sites mentioned, did we consider dropping any of them in terms of, having more parking at, maybe the Valencia and Rio Vista and dropping Pine Street for either cost savings or efficiency purposes?
So
Question one.
the three, if I can respond to that real quick, this is my understanding, and by all means, correct me if any of this doesn't line up, is that the three sites that we've shown here are a function of where each of the medium and heavy duty vehicles is currently domiciled. And so one strategy would be to just simply reassign where those vehicles are domiciled and narrow down your sites.
Okay. So that, yeah, because I know it periodically comes up about, reducing the number of sites that we have. So that was just a thought, but it sounds like based on current configuration and maybe if we hit a roadblock at one area, we can consider moving more parking to an area that's easier to permit or install. And then two other questions. Time, you mentioned 18-month lead time. Is that Edison lead time or is that CARB lead time? Or what is that 18-month?
It's a function of cooperating with the utility subsidy programs. It's largely a function of that. So if you were to tell me, hey, how can we shorten this, to, 12 months or less, I would say you'd need to do that. Maybe not through the subsidy program, but then you give up the subsidy.
Okay, so that's the subsidy timing. How is the install timing going for these type chargers? Is Edison getting it done quickly? Because I know they can be very slow.
Well, as far as the installation goes, I don't know that I would put that on Edison, because the trenching and stuff on your sites, Edison doesn't necessarily have total control over that. So I don't think you can escape. I don't think, as far as the physical trenching, redoing hardscape, backfilling trenches, all that, there's no way to really escape that time drain.
I guess I was thinking of like Edison approval, any Edison approvals needed, maybe if we don't have the appropriate power at the curb. So that there, I've done power pole installs that take like 2 years to just move a power pole. So do we think that this would take that long, or is Edison approval not needed? Do we have enough power that we don't care what Edison does because we have enough power today and it's our side that we're going to be installing? Do you know?
Each project will be different. And there's different components within that project that will have some delays, right? Starting from the permitting process, or as you mentioned, getting power to that site. It might also depend on the properties around the area, right? Who else is requesting power? Some delays can also occur with the charging infrastructure itself, or even with some of the switch gear. So each one of those will be a little different. And I think, this is why we wanted to kind of bring this, you know, from a really big picture. These are some of the challenges that we'll encounter as we start down this journey for the infrastructure. Some of it might be internally, right, with other upgrades that we might have to do across the yard. So it may not necessarily be just the power. It might be other aspects of the project that will make those long lead times, the 18 months plus.
Okay. And last question, I think it came up in our discussion before. Will we be able to have any solar or battery power to these chargers or not?
That will be part of Jesus, the overall strategy. Yep.
Sorry, I just want to make a quick comment on that. It's certainly theoretically possible. It adds complexity to it. There are potentially some benefits through the low carbon fuel standard and what kinds of monetary incentives one might generate from that. But it does add complexity. Sorry, Jesus, go ahead.
So that will really be part of kind of our agency's overall strategy when it comes to the charging. One of the biggest concerns for us will be emergency preparedness. So because of that, we will definitely include some possibly some battery storage and on-site power generation to some of the projects to be able to address those situations when there is no power. One of the other things that you kind of alluded to with your question, right, is how do we decide how many chargers to put in at each location? One of the things that we're hearing from other fleets too is there may be issues with a certain site, with certain chargers being down, or certain issues that could occur. So we definitely don't want to have all of our chargers at one site. So we want to be a little strategic to be able to spread the chargers. And one of the things that also helps with that, it also reduces the amount of power that's required for each site. So, right, the more power that you require at each site, the more complex the project will become. So, but yeah, we'll include some emergency preparedness and look at battery storage and some solar into each of those projects. But okay. As Matt mentioned, it'll be a little bit more complex.
Of course. All right. Thank you.
Director Armitage.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. So first of all, thank you for this update so early on, and thank you for the presentation. I have a couple questions and one comment. So I feel like maybe I'm forgetting or missing a piece. So I'm wondering why this was focused on just medium and heavy duty vehicles.
Yeah. So the reason for that is this new regulation called the Advanced Clean Fleet Regulation, which became active essentially in January. Mm-hmm. And just by virtue of the scope of that regulation, which is medium and heavy duty, that's what explains this particular focus, which again is only on road, only vehicles over 8,500 pounds.
Okay. Thank you. I guess I forgot that. So the amount of chargers and the capacity for each charger, does this also give capacity for non-agency owned vehicles to also be charged at the sites? And did we, I mean, did we want that ability to be able to do that?
Yeah, so Jesus, let me say something about that. Now, first, and that is, there's technically speaking, there's nothing preventing the equipment that we're talking about from being used on light duty vehicles. However, I think the rest of this answer is belongs to somebody like Jesus or Kim.
I believe that we that's going to have to be a policy that we look into and look at the risks of having employees charge and at what point we bring that in or not allow it or allow it and or even open it up to other public to be able to charge. So it is something that we've discussed. It's something that we have to look at this point. More leaning towards not allowing, but again, it's a policy that we have to look at and investigate a little bit more.
Okay, so you're thinking about it. Plus, we're trying to get our own infrastructure in
up and running yeah.
first. Yeah. Okay. And then just my comment was from when you were describing the challenges at the Pine Street location. I just want to say thank you for working around the oak trees. they're just, I always want to advocate that they're important keystone species trees, and I appreciate us leaving them alone. So that's it. Thank you.
I noticed that one of at least one unit you're talking about is 400 amps. Is that 400 amps for one vehicle, or is it 400 amps for a total of a number of vehicles?
No, it's for one. So here's what explains that. And I know it's pretty extreme. If you have a heavy vehicle, class 6, 7, 8 vehicle that's used over a relatively long distance and its parking duration is relatively short, that's how you end up with the 400 amp requirement. However, what we're showing here, again, has a safety margin built in. So it's sort of representative of a worst case. So it when it comes down to doing a really detailed assessment, in other words, after the particular vehicle is chosen and really seriously stepping back and considering that parking duration, you may be able to find a way to pull that down from 400 amp, 300 amp maybe, or something like that. The other thing here too, I have to be careful not to go too far in the weeds here, but each vehicle can accept energy at different rates and they react differently as you begin to charge them. All vehicles, they will start at a high power and then they will drop off at some rate as the battery starts to heat up. So what does that curve look like for the particular vehicle that you chose? Maybe it's, allowing you to use a lower power unit over that parking duration. So anyway, there's a lot of moving parts here. It may not necessarily need to be a 400 amp unit, but looking at the first level math on this, it looks like that's what would be needed for the particular vehicle.
Yeah, that is correct. And each of those questions, right, we'll be using data to really help fine tune all of those questions. So the number of chargers, the type of chargers that we need will be kind of a combination of looking at each vehicle, the type of battery that it's going to need, the typical trips that that vehicle makes, and then also the dwell time, right? How long is it sitting at one location so that we can figure out, okay, how long is it going to take to charge that battery? And do we have enough time while it's parking? And that's where our telematics data is going to play a big role to be able to answer those questions.
Exactly. That was my second question, by the way, but you answered it. As far as length of times and all those kind of things, you're working through those formulas now, it sounds like. Do we have any other questions?
Well, just as we work through this, is there... Sound like there's a deadline to turn something into CARB for grant funding application. Are we able to turn in our estimate now and then revise it later?
Yeah, just to be clear, what CARB needs is for compliance purposes, and the deadline for that is by April, and it's just a list of vehicles, but it has nothing to do with the grant part. The grant money that may be available would come through Edison primarily. And as far as deadlines around that, you know, it's sort of like everything else. It's the sooner the better. And the reason for that is because there's only a certain amount of money available, and it's first come, first serve.
Right. Okay. So we're going to be figuring out the refinements soon and turning it into Edison soon as well.
Right. And just roughly speaking, essentially what Edison does when someone expresses interest is they say, they ask you, how many vehicles will you be deploying and over what period of time? And then they'll go through a similar process that you know we've gone through here to make determinations about what equipment they believe is needed, what the costs associated with it are, and how much they're willing to, or how much the program can contribute to that installation.
Okay.
Yeah, and we've also submitted our first application for the first location, which will be Summit Circle. That location does not have any medium or heavy duty vehicles, so it's all just light duty. So it's in some ways the easiest of the locations. Mm-hmm. So we'll look at each site, and then we'll also look at the requirements, right, for any available grants. Some of them might be tied to access to public chargers, so we'll evaluate those different conditions and requirements as well as we go through the process.
Since you just said Summit Circle, that I want to add another question. We had talked about, and I forgot where it was, about you know potentially eliminating properties or consolidating or buying new property and getting rid of some. How does that mesh with this? So we don't install a bunch of stuff where we're not going to end up being.
I think that's another question. Okay. Maybe another topic.
I would like to know that was at least considered and mulled over, and maybe the property that we're most likely to not have in 20 years or 10 years, we don't put chargers there.
Right. So there's opportunity possibly for some property next to Pine Street
to buy.
We would eliminate maybe the Golden Triangle location and move it all over there. But that hasn't been, you know, determined yet. But so there's always going to be maybe those opportunities. But, you know, the locations that we're probably going to be in for a while, Rockefeller, Rio Vista, the treatment plant, that's not going to go anywhere. We can focus on those. And we're going to focus currently on Rockefeller so we can get some. I mean, on Rio Vista. So
do we own this location here?
We own the building, but this is part of HF.
Thank you.
More to come, sounds like.
Yeah.
With that, thank you, Matt and Jesus. More to come, I'm sure, about this topic.
Thank you all for your time.
Tells me otherwise, I'll drop off here, but thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right, we'll move on to item number 3 now. That is the recommend approval of revised employee manual number 7, employment status policy.
Awesome. So this is a night of employment policies, pretty much. As we go, you know, along periodically, we find policies that need to be updated, whether it's a situation or something is triggered, oh, let's look at that policy and maybe it doesn't really apply anymore. Maybe the law has changed, maybe for practical purposes, because most of these policies were adopted in 2018 when we merged, so some things just need to be refined and explained a little bit better. So the first one is Employee Manual 7.0, which is employment status and work policy. And part of that is Section 714, which we added in the red line, and it mostly just clarifies the Y step rating. There was some language in there, but not a lot. So when, you know, we use Y rating, it's usually to when we reclassify or restructure We did that a couple times when we merged, because if you have, you know, people that are in one position, but now that position no longer exists, you put them in another position, but you don't want to take away their pay because the agency reclassified them. But we wanted to clarify, because it's come up a couple times, with there's a new position that's open in the agency and somebody maybe wants to change their career path, maybe they're in engineering and want to go to finance, but maybe the position they're applying for gets paid less. Mm-hmm. We're saying that we're not Y rating them because they're voluntarily applying for a position and they will get paid the pay rate of that position. So we just wanted to clarify that. So I didn't, like, you know, our receptionist that didn't apply for, and you can pay me as what I'm paying now, but, you know, I would be at a lower class. So this just says that if I, you know, anyone applies for a position, they take the range of pay that's in that position. So that's just clarifying language. And so we would just recommend that the committee recommend to the board to approve the policy as shown.
With that, do we have any public comment about this item?
None this time. None online either.
Thank you. Any questions from the board members? None? You can put this on the consent calendar.
Consent.
Consent.
Yep.
We have consent.
Consent for consent.
Item number four, recommend approval of revised employee manual number 9, pay plan.
So this one, as with the last one, sometimes as we go through our processes, we find something that we can potentially change, and for this would be for the employees' benefits. Right now, we do promotions. When we're talking about promotions, there's step promotions, internal promotion from 1 to 2, 2 to 3. We do those usually at performance evaluation time once a year. If there's a open recruitment and somebody gets promoted, that can happen at any time. But we're talking about just pay grade steps as step promotions. And we did those once a year, but, you know, what was, you know, brought to our attention of like, oh, well, I'm going to get my certificate that I need to go from 1 to 2 in August. And now I have to wait a whole another year to get that to that 2 position. And so we created this mid-year promotion for just career path advancements. So that's somebody from a 1 to going to a 2 or 2 to 3, if they have two things. It has to be in their performance evaluation. So it's one of their career goals that if you achieve this, then you could apply for this. And it has to be budgeted for planned. So the supervisor going through their performance evaluation has to know, so we know, to budget for some type of mid-year promotion. And so we said that can happen once a year. It's in January. It splits the year. And so we added it for consideration for in our employee manual pay plan. That concludes my report. If there's any questions.
Any comments from the public?
No online.
Questions from the board members?
I just one thing that I noticed under 9.1, the agency employee shall be paid by check every other Friday. Doesn't everybody pretty much have auto pay by now? Do we want to say by check? Okay. Does it have to say that?
No, we can just say gets paid.
Yeah. It felt a little old antiquated.
Yeah,
I heard
that. Yeah, some of the things are.
And then I do have one question about the, if they're promoted between July and December 31, they may be considered for a two-step merit increase versus if it's between January 1 and January 30, it's a one-step. And it's probably in line with what you just said, but for some reason it's not clicking.
So it follows the same as a regular promotion or a new position. So if there was somebody hired between July and December, they would be eligible for a two-step merit increase at their performance evaluation time. If they're hired between January and June, they would be eligible for a one-step promotion. So it just follows the same logic for promotion.
Okay.
Vice President Gutzeit, you have any?
No questions. I'm fine with consent on this too.
Well, I'm fine too with consent. I think this policy helps a little bit the employees that have received their certifications early part of the year. We can get a mid-year adjustment and promotion. It's more easily now. So we'll put that on consent. Item number five is the recommended approval for the shift work policy. It's annual number 12.
So we have a short presentation. So go ahead, next slide. So to start off, we, a couple of times this 4-10 schedule has come up. During our strategic plan SWOT meetings, when Ed Means had his all of his meetings with staff, this schedule came up as something that could help, you know, with morale and just different working schedules, better work-life balance. And it also came up in the communication survey that we did internally. And I think we mentioned through some of the strategic plan sessions, though, that we're working on something to respond to some of those comments that we received. This is a result. We've been working on it kind of for a while. It's a pretty simple policy, but we did spend the time. We did our benchmark surveys, and that goes through the presentation. But this is just kind of a, you know, quick. We'll have, I'm sure, quite a bit of discussion, but... So the 4-10 schedule is for those employees pretty much that are not eligible for the flexible workplace program. So those who, the eligibility list is you're eligible for the flexible workplace program, you're not eligible for the 4-10. If you're eligible for the 4-10, flip-flops, you're not eligible for the other. Mm-hmm. And it's primarily all of those positions mostly were in operations, right? They can't do their job working from home, so they don't get that benefit of not being on the road 1 or 2 days a week. And the employees in operations and customer care department, they need to be there. So this was a way for them to still get a little bit of that benefit, still putting in those hours, but have that 3-day weekend. So the eligible positions would be Monday through Thursday with every Friday off for the 4-10. Next slide. So the 4-10 versus the 980, we know it's 4 consecutive days, 10-hour days. And the 980 is you have 9 work days at 9 hours and the last day being 8 to total your 8 hours. Majority of our staff are already on that. Our laboratory does work the 840s. They need to work that because they have to be here every Friday to make sure that they're doing their samples every day. So that's their work schedule. Our treatment plant operators are on a 7-on, 7-off with 12-hour work days. So they have an 84-hour pay period work week. But the rest of the staff are on some form of 980. Mm-hmm. Next slide. So the benefits of the 4-10 work schedule, and these benefits came from our survey results along with some research that we did. Of course, employees will have the benefit of an extended weekend. They'll have a reduced commute to be help the environment a little bit by not having them being, you know, on the commute 1 extra day a week. Increased productivity. It's been shown that, you know, your longer workday, you can get more work done in that longer workday rather than, you know, having to clean up and then come back the next day. You can finish what you're doing. Employee satisfaction, it's all employees find it as a huge benefit. And of course, for recruitment and retention. When we look at our survey, most of our neighboring agencies who we compete with pretty much, they are offering it. And it's one thing that we do not offer. Next slide. So in our survey, in our attachment, what's labeled as attachment one is our surveyed benchmark agencies. We have 10 benchmark agencies, and then there were two others that are neighboring. One was the city and one was Palmdale that we've used in the past. So 9 of those 12 surveyed either offer 410, or there's a couple that are, they have bargaining units and they're negotiating it right now. So a significant number of the agencies that we do compete with are offering the 410 for the, especially for the operations group. Next slide. So for the financial impact, it's pretty much, it's not on customer service side, it's more on the operations side because we do have staff that are on call. So for those Fridays, we have on-call staff and standby staff to cover that additional Friday off. It's estimated that that is about $60,000. And we have put in the budget about up to $160,000 in case there is a leak on that Friday. We have to call crews in to fix a leak. And that's one leak every Friday. Does that happen every Friday? Probably not. So it's probably, it's at a very high number, but we wanted to make sure that we would account for it if it did happen. Next slide. And concludes my report, and we just recommend that the F&A committee recommend that the board of directors approved the revised employee manual policy number 12, support policy for the 410 schedule.
Thank you, Rochelle. Any public comments?
Just that we probably wouldn't approve of that proposal.
No online public comment at this time.
Okay. With that, questions from the board members? I'm
So I just want to say thank you to you and your staff for doing all the research and before bringing this to us. I know that when the flexible workplace policy went into effect, I know that there were some that weren't able to take advantage of that and felt that maybe it wasn't fair. So I very much appreciate that this is bringing, you know, brought to us for consideration. I think that the list of benefits that you presented to us are absolutely true. And I feel like work-life balance is such an important component and something that we really do need to pay attention to and keep in mind. So I'm very supportive of this. I'm very happy that hopefully there's consensus. This is something that we can offer to the employees. I sent a question to you ahead of time today asking about the additional funds. And you explained that there's not enough staff to split them so that there could be coverage on both Mondays and Fridays. And so the only question I had kind of as a follow-up, and that is, if we're already budgeting up to $160,000 without knowing all the costs for the additional staff, but I guess my devil's advocate question is, would it be worth hiring an additional 1 to 2 people, assuming that fits into the numbers? Would that be enough to create that balance to provide Monday through Friday operation service?
Well, I know Mike is on the line, but I'm going to go out on a limb here. So your $160,000 would not probably cover 2 staff.
Okay.
And we have many departments, right? So we have water quality, we have water systems, which is your production. We have utility workers. So you'd have to, you know, have a crew or a portion of a crew for each one of those sections. So, I don't,
so no.
So
absolutely not. Okay, just wanted to throw it out there. And then the only thing I think for customers who have questions that happen to be on a Friday, if they're calling in with questions, what happens if they're reaching out for help on a Friday?
So they go to the answering service, which they do now. So every other Friday, we're off anyway. It's been working well for years. So the answering service is well known. They've been with us for a long time. So that's, they take the call. If they can't answer it, they go to the on-call people. So that's why we have on-call personnel. So they go, they know who to call if there's a leak or if there's a water quality issue. A lot of times they're just taking messages because it can wait until Monday. If it's somebody who's moving in, they'll call the on-call person. They'll go out, they make sure the water's turned on. So it's no different than any of the other Fridays that we're off.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense, and I'm supportive.
That person, good site.
Multiple questions. So this is an option that's going to be offered. Not everybody's going to like automatically go to 410, right?
Every department would have to work together to go on the 410.
What does that mean?
So all of the operations, they've already had said yes.
They're already all
on board. Customer care is on board. Okay. So everybody that it will be offered to who is on the eligibility list is already has shown support.
Okay. So yeah, that so there for sure it'll just be like an extra Friday closed.
Right.
And then what happens then? Because I was thinking, I have some personal experience with this. If people have grow into a need to maybe have increased doctor visits or student activities after school, like, you know, their kid goes and joins football or something, and they want out of the 410 for that reason. Is that an option, or is it just once everybody's in, you're in?
So the policy goes back to the manager or the supervisor to go and have those discussions if they can do a different type of schedule.
Okay. So that would still be an option because I know some people get off fairly early. Like, don't they, do they do like 7:30
to 4 o'clock?
Yeah.
30 to 4.
Yeah. So the longer days can be a problem if people have.
Well, 6 to 4:30. So it's not, I mean, they're coming in a half hour earlier and staying a half hour later.
Okay. And then I am assuming that if this is agreed to, it's obviously not subject to overtime if that's their schedule.
Only overtime after the
Okay. And you already answered. Yes. So basically, for the departments that have said yes, it's going to be a yes for everybody unless somebody needs to ask for a special discount or special
accommodation.
Yeah. Okay. All right. It seems fine to me. I know, you know, like South Coast Water Management District's closed every Monday. It's just closed every Monday and people learn. Other than leaks, I don't think of anything that couldn't be covered in 4 days, right? Emergencies and leaks is about it. I actually thought the 160,000 was low for, that's for a year's worth of potential.
That's the 26 days, so the additional 26 Fridays that they would not be working. That would be one crew to come out to repair one leak for 8 hours in a day.
Do we have contract services?
I don't believe we have those anymore because we have our own crews.
So like if Valencia Boulevard, it gets a sinkhole, it'll be our people fixing it.
Yes.
Okay.
And this policy will be communicated between now and July, and since the funds need to be included in the budget, we have a July start date for the policy.
Okay. And well, I'll just say, since you're on the record of supporting, I'm on the record of supporting the flexible option if people need to do something in the evenings, if it works for the, you know, the department to opt out.
Well, I'm on board with it too. Even though I go back to days when we all had to work 5 days a week. So, but I think it does provide an opportunity for us that don't know what Friday is off or what Friday is on. We will have an opportunity and now know all Fridays are off.
Well, not for everybody. So we'll be working Friday.
With that, should we put this on consent?
I think it's interesting enough to discuss, but I don't mind if it goes on consent and nobody pulls it. Yeah. If they want to pull it, pull
it. All right. Okay. Should I ask you to get everything on consent?
Uh-huh.
This one coming up probably won't be. So item number 7 is the review of COLA data and
recommendations. No, we have one more policy.
6.
Oh, well, those are kind of...
learning together.
They're all... Okay, I'm sorry. Item number 6 is recommend approval of various revised employee policies. Rochelle, please.
So these were combined together. There's 3 policies where there were some legislative changes. So those have been adjusted, and those are coming forward. And there are just a couple general policy updates where the policy hasn't really changed. It's just been reworded in a different way. So on policy number 5, which is the drug-free workplace, AB 2188, that was in attachment 1. That has some protections for the cannabis screening for employment. So in your pre-employment testing, you can't test for recreational use of cannabis. And then if there is a workplace incident, they would only test for the psychoactive cannabis and not the non-psychoactive cannabis. So that was that change. And policy number 20 is the 20.2 has to do with the paid sick days. California had approved at least 3 days before, and now they've expanded that to 5 days or 40 hours. So we changed that in our policy. We already made those changes internally, but we're changing our policy. And on 20.4, there was that requires employers with 5 or more employees to grant eligible employees up to 5 days of leave following a reproductive loss. And it's unpaid leave, but they can use their sick time or any other leave that they have. But it's kind of a job protection for those 5 days so they can take that time off. Under the general policy updates, policy number 6, which is the recruitment and hiring, we had a section in there for disaster service workers before, and we just have cleaned it up and expanded it a little bit, made it a little bit more clear. We're adding it to our ID cards now, which are now in here, so we just refined it a bit. And then on policy number 10, which is the overtime, the comp time, which you guys approved a couple months ago, but now that it's in effect and working, we found out that somebody put 2.25 hours of comp time and our payroll system can't pay a quarter hour at time and a half. So we just changed it to, it has to be in 30-minute increments, and the employee could just take the extra quarter hour as overtime instead of comp time. So that was cleaned up. So those were the changes to the miscellaneous policies. That concludes my report.
Thank you. Any other comments?
What item are you on? Number six.
Various revised employee policies.
To say that so far we haven't been too happy with the decisions.
With that, any public comment?
No online comment at this time.
Any of that? Or any comments?
No, that's good. Straightforward.
But complying with state laws. And with that, we'll put this on consent. Now we move on to item number 7 is review COLA data and recommend approval of a proposed employee salary adjustment or COLA for fiscal year 24-25. We have Rochelle, but I know we have Matt Stone online, so.
Matt, would you like me to do the report?
I'll just give a little summary of the thinking behind it, and you can follow through with the numbers. But we conferred on this. As often happens, you know, a little history, which I think you all are familiar with. We have used the CPI as one of the measuring points for the committee and then the board to consider. It is the board's discretion every year, and we try to balance a number of factors, both budgetary and remaining competitive for our workforce. We have both CPI and ECI indexes that we've recently been looking at as reference points. After that came up a number of years ago, I think when Director Cawley proposed that we also get that data. So we have that data, and this year they're I think about 2% apart, roughly. So we run an analysis kind of using the bounds of that range and the middle of that range to give the board an idea of what the impacts would be of different alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'll just add to that. So at the 3%, which we show in the staff report, it has a smaller impact to the budget because we had already included 3% as a budgetary assumption when we did the first year of our biennial budget. And the small amount that's in there is for new staff that's being proposed. So there would be some additional costs there. And at 4%, and this is salaries and benefits, it's $328,000 on top of the budget that we currently have. And then at 5%, which is the ECI number, would be $639,000, almost $640,000 budgetary impact. With that, I guess we'll just go to committee discussion because staff didn't recommend, only provided the data for the data points.
Okay. Any public comment? No? Any online?
No online comment as well.
Okay, we have some numbers. I'll just open it up for discussion from both of your, get your feelings for them. Let me just address my feeling about it is that we should try to remain competitive and provide these adjustments to the salaries. And it's really more of trying to stay with the economies that we are going through these days in our work and plus living environments. And that my thought is that we go with, in the middle of the road, 4%. So that's my opinion. I'll leave it up to you guys to see what your thoughts.
Yeah. Is ECI private sector or public sector or both?
Public
sector. Okay. I always like to talk about the frugal penny pinching private sector. one of the managers recently was telling me, they're having trouble hiring people, because his statement was, even though CPI was only 3% and change in December, it never went down. So it's just gone up and up and up. So it's 3% compared to the year before, but the year before was higher compared to the year before that. So do people continue to feel the impact of inflation because we haven't had deflation? So, and they're having trouble hiring at the prices they want because people are just not taking the job. Sometimes I wonder if more money is going to help, but at least in certain industries, it seems like they just can't find workers. But I would be in favor of the 4% for the same reason, primarily for retention. I think when we have good staff, we need to keep them and not lose them to particularly other agencies.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like 4% was a nice place to land because it's right between the 3% for the CPI and the 5% for the ECI. 4% feels like a comfortable place for me as well. I don't have much to add to what you mentioned.
So I would say the Finance Committee recommends 4%. And then we'd probably have to discuss that during the budget process. before the budget process? Or
well, this will go to the board meeting, and then mm-hmm. once it's approved, then we'll incorporate it yeah. into the budget.
If I may, I want to mention that this came up, well, employee retention and things like that came up at the Urban Water Institute. Really interesting comments from Jeff Keitlinger. If anybody heard his comments about aging workforce and recruiting new people and stuff, I think it's part of the whole package that hopefully we're looking at as to how to get more people into the business. And he said at one point, it was something like I don't know if it was, I have my notes, I didn't memorize them. Like at one point they had like two people under 30 at Met. Like everybody was like, I think when he came on, it was like a lot of people over 50. Everybody else is like over 40, a few between 30 and 40. He's like, we have to get more people in here. We're sunk. But at the same time, they also streamlined and they ended up having staff reductions, but having more depth all the way in the age band. So it's interesting. And I know we're looking at that issue too, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So we have direction to the board for a 4% COLA. Mm-hmm.
So this is action?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to be action. Okay. Item 7 is complete. Item number 8 is the review of the budget calendar.
So this is just informational, just kind of let you know what our process is. We've already sent out all of our expense budgets to the departments. Their departments are working on them. They're due back to the finance group March 4th. We take all those numbers, we compile them, we refine them, we send them back to say justify. And then we gather all the information. In March, we have quite a few new positions that are being recommended. So we will bring that. And then once the committee and the board decide on those will be incorporated into the budget. The capital plan is expected to go to the E&O committee April 4th, but everyone's pretty much seen the capital plan mm-hmm. as we've gone through all these financing scenarios and Arithia. I mean, nothing has really changed, but it will, you know, just as a refresher of what the capital plan is, we'll incorporate that into our revised budget, and we'll be presenting that to the F&A committee in May. And then it will go to the full board in June. And this isn't the full narrative budget packet because this is just the second year of the budget. So it's mostly just spreadsheets and reports and just in a really condensed format as the board has already conditionally approved that second year budget, but there will be refinements.
Thank you. Any public comment?
We don't support.
Any online public comment?
Not at this time.
And any questions for sure? We got the plan.
Do we think that it's going to fit within the conditionally approved second year, or are we going to need changes?
Well, any changes that we have typically will come out of the PAYGO capital budget, but there will be some changes. I mean, just like costs have been bladed. I mean, we've, by even approving a 4% COLA, right? Those right. costs have changed. I haven't seen them yet. Mm-hmm. So I'll have a better idea next week of what each department's, you know, are thinking.
Oh, great.
I don't know. Budgets typically don't go less, but that's one of the things that we do when we look at it. We look at what has been already spent to date, what's been projected. And if any department is projecting, you know, an extra 30%, it's like, that's our question to them. It's like, why are you, you know, budgeting extra 30% when you haven't spent money now? And it's like, oh, well, maybe this report, we can get to what is happening, you know, next year. And so we just want that justification so we can justify it to you of why some of the budgets could be changing.
So we're going to approve line item changes and then potentially
It'll be by department. It will be, we usually don't go into the line item detail, although we will have it.
That, but
yeah.
department.
Yeah.
It, but and then the total for the next year right. could also change.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. Now we are on item number 10, because we already did the presentation in 99. This is recommend receiving and filing the December 2023 monthly fiscal year 23-24 second quarter financial report and mid-year budget review.
Yeah.
All one shot.
Yeah. It gets kind of confused because the mid-year report is the same as the second quarter ending. So we add a couple for the budget review, and then the rest is just the quarterly report. So go ahead and go to the next slide. I'm not going to go through all these, but these are some of the things that, you know, this committee has worked on and we have approved. And this is the quarter ending December, so October, November, December 2023. See, next slide. So when we look at the budget review, we're looking at, we have our, on the left-hand side, we have our 2023-2024 budget. And then we have what 50% of that would be, because we're halfway through the year, and then what our actuals are through December, halfway mm-hmm. through the year. And this is our revenues, so all of our investment revenues, other facility capacity, grants, reimbursements, annexations, property tax, state water contract property tax, and then water sales. So we can see that we are just on our revenues, we are just below our target, our 50% target for our revenues. And you know, we're a little bit short on our water sales, as we know. We'll go through that a little bit later. And also some of our grants and reimbursements we have not received yet on time. Some, you know, our grants have been delayed a bit. Although we have received quite a bit more on the facility capacity fees that we had anticipated, our investment revenues are pretty much on target, and our property tax is about on target too. So next slide. So this just takes those other little components and breaks down the major ones. So we see our water sales on the left. And although our water sales here shows a little bit higher because it's just taking 50%. But typically in our first half of the year, we receive about 60% of our revenues. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the mathematical equation here. So it doesn't really say if we're over or under budget per se, but we are above the 50% mark. Mm-hmm. On our 1% property tax, we're right about even, and our facility capacity revenue there on the bottom left is much higher than anticipated. And our property tax revenue for the state water contract is just a little bit low, but we still expect that bigger payments like official. Next slide. So when we are looking here, these are all of our revenues. We kind of look to that percentage of the budget on the right, and we're like, okay, are we close to 50%? You know, what is off? And we get down to... you know, I don't know, like miscellaneous fees and charges. I mean, 95% of the budget, you know, so we had budgeted low. Those are the fees and charges that are charged to the customer for late fees, reconnect fees, return check fees. We budgeted low because coming out of COVID, you know, we didn't have any. And so we budgeted low, but we've already received 472,000. So almost 100% of our annual budget. And then where we're looking at our PERC reimbursements, we received 81%. So we received more of our PERC reimbursements than we thought. And then down at the bottom, 219% of our capacity fees and our connection fees. So we budgeted 1.57 for the year and received 3.4 million. When we look at the rest of the categories, they're really not too low. I mean, we... the grant reimbursement at 4%, that's the one driver.
Do we expect those this year?
Well, we're still, you know, hoping. We never know when they're going to come.
It's tied to the issue we talked about, public
EOL, yeah.
They were very concerned with the state budget. And
yes.
So
hopefully it'll be coming towards the end of the year for expenses that we've already incurred for those approved grants.
And what is the annexation? and reimbursement, the 0%? Would some annexation then go through?
I think they were billed in December, and so they may have just been not come through here. Next slide. So for this is their mid-year state water contract revenue summary. We have our agency set property tax, and then we have some interest revenue. Next slide. So here's our expense summary. So we have our budget on the left, 50% of our budget, and then through December 31st, we're actually quite a bit below budget on our expenses. It's kind of the bottom section, which is our operating expenses. I mean, it pretty much shows that's one of our bigger expenses. Our debt service, we pay our debt service, our principal towards at the beginning of the year, and our interest in February. So that's when you see a little bit higher that we paid on the right-hand side in that blue section. It just so happens because we pay more principal at the beginning of the year and interest at the second half of the year. Next slide. So the same thing we do for the revenue. These are our expenses by department. So we're just looking for, anything that sticks out so we can dig a little deeper. And that's where you see like debt service, 82%. That's because that $30 million was principal, and then we'll repay the remaining, which is interest, in February. And then when we kind of look, we're kind of below budget and a lot of things. The 52% for water quality treatment and maintenance is pretty close, but that has a lot to do with power costs at the treatment plants. So otherwise, I mean, it looks pretty pretty good on the expense side. Next slide. And then here's the same thing for expenses for the state water contract. We have our variable and our fixed charges for the state water contract. And then there's the audit finance. We pay that one time. So it's 100%, but it's not going to change at the end of the year. That's just one fee that we pay. Next slide. So here's, now we're into our quarterly. That was the mid-year budget. So here's our quarter. We can see that of our total revenues, our actual is a little bit higher than budget, and I think most of that has to do with our connection fees, but that's just showing the total revenues. Next slide. So here's our water sales. We're actually slightly higher in our water sales in December than we had budgeted, but still year to date, we are still a little bit below budget. Looks like total water sales were $49 billion, a reduction of 18% compared to our budget at 59.4. So still year to date, that's where that gap is. We're still below budget in water sales. Next slide. So here's the water sales by customer class. And we can see the water sales by customer class. We're still seeing the biggest total reduction in residential, although we're seeing a lot of reduction in irrigation customers. I still think that has a lot to do with the city. They really, when we had our drought, they really did a lot of work with the medians, and it's just maintained. So we'll definitely be looking at our historical information, especially for irrigation, when we do our next rate study. Next slide. On our property tax revenues, we are year to date higher than budget. Next slide. And on our facility capacity fees, we've received almost 3.5 million of capacity fees out of our budget of, I'm sorry, budget was 3.4 million, 3.1, almost 3.2 on the regional side. And about 267,000 in retail capacity fees. Go to the next slide and we can see where those are coming from. So the most connections, there were some other, so there's some smaller developments out there, but Lennar Homes had 26 connections. And year to date, they've seen the most growth, 125. Next slide. So we do have other revenues. So we've already talked about our property tax, talked about our facility capacity fees and our miscellaneous revenue. And on our miscellaneous revenue, that green section is has those reimbursements, grants reimbursements, the PERC O&M reimbursements. So it's slightly lower because of that grant revenue. Next slide. And then our investment portfolio, this is just the front cover, the detail is in your packet. We just like to see here that the average purchase year to date is 4.5%. So we're still seeing a really good return on our investments. Next slide. On our capital improvement program, out of our $76 million of PAYGO, we've spent $11 million, and that's through December. And on our capital funded on the right of our budget of $46 million, we've spent about $13 million and growing. If you look at in the packet, there's all of the projects in here, and you can also look at the committed costs. So those are ones that we've already have purchase orders out, but they just haven't been paid yet. So on our PAYGO side, there's an extra $6.5 million that's committed but not yet paid. And on our debt service, there's an additional $6 million that's been committed but not yet paid as of December. Next slide. And this just goes through the operating expenditures. We already kind of saw it by department when we did the mid-year budget, but I think nearly all of our departments are under budget, except for maybe slightly on the water quality and treatment. Next slide. And our cash position. We show this every month. Our restricted cash is $187 million, but that includes our state water contract, any capacity fees that we have that are restricted, our reserves of $122 million, and our unrestricted cash of $19 million. And over there on the right is our reserves are that $102 million, our $22 million is funded. Next slide. And then since this is a quarterly report, it's very big. So you'll have the statement of revenues and expenses for December, which includes the year to date. It has the 15-ish pages of our investment report, has our 3-month cash flow, the debt and cash position graphs, the facility capacity fee revenues with some additional charts. The 10 largest disbursements, check register, the credit card register, which is quite a bit longer than it used to be. Director stipends and director reimbursements. So that concludes my report, unless there's any other questions.
Thank you. Any questions from the public?
Not at this time.
On the line, any questions for Rochelle from the board members?
I know we used to have to, I still have to disclose some things from the consolidation that were required for transparency reasons. Are we including a lot of extra items in the reporting that are not required to be disclosed?
Yes.
We are. Okay. And that came from...
The cash position, that's not required to be there. We do our statement of revenues and expenses. We have to do our investments every month. We had pared it down significantly at the time of the merger and figured it would grow as we received, comments. If there's anything you don't want to see anymore, let me know and we can look to see if it's still required and we can take it out. But some of the things we have to show, director stipends, we have to show, but it's kind of up to the committee of what you want to see.
I just have one question, and I was trying to remember. We've been doing a lot of recoding of reservoirs lately. Where's those finance from? Is it PAYGO?
I think that's PAYGO.
It's PAYGO. Okay. I was trying to remember. And I'm sure after seeing some pictures at the board meeting, we're going to be doing more of those.
Yeah.
In the next years.
That's pretty bad looking.
Yep. So with that, we'll move on to the planning calendar, which is item number 11.
So there's a couple other policy updates, or actually not updates, new policies that we're going to add ahead of the audit. I've talked about before the internal control policy, and then just some adjustments to our capitalization policy for fixed assets. I feel like we do this every month, but we'll have a revised classification plan, one that if it's approved, the 4% COLA is approved, we'll have this new classification plan and a new position control. Also with going through, management has provided their needs of staff. So we'll be presenting those justifications in March and what the financial impacts would be, incorporating them into the budget. So that will, I'm anticipating to be pretty large item. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty much the highlights for next month.
We need comments on the public?
Not online either.
We'll move on. Any questions from the board members? And item 12 is request for future agenda items.
I have none. No, new shortage of agenda items.
Can't think of anything to add. And then the last item will be the general report of finance and administration activities, item 13.
So if you have just like 10 minutes, the finance department with HR has been working on one of our strategic goals, which is developing a career path. Mm-hmm. So you can visually see, employees can see, they would see what they need. They can see what each department needs. So there's like many departments, but this is kind of what we've started to create. So Erica, you could go to the next slide. I know this is small, but this is kind of what you'd see. And we would anticipate this will either be on the employee's SharePoint site to see as well as the website. And what we're doing here is we're looking for the gaps. So we can see like in that middle section, this happens to be the finance and accounting department. So in the middle, we see the accounting supervisor in the blue, and then it goes straight up to the controller. And so if we're looking for a career path or career ladder, that might be a gap that we want to fill. It's like, okay, we have a supervisor, maybe we need a manager or assistant controller, something to fill that gap because it's a big jump from one to the other. Also, what I wanted to show each one, so the employees on each one of these items, the job classifications, you can click on it online and it sends you directly to governmentjobs.com. So the employee can go and they can read the job description. They can see what the eligibility requirements are, what their abilities need to be. On the left-hand side, it's really hard to see on those boxes, but it tells you what education that you would need to qualify for that position. Mm-hmm. On the right, it tells you what type of experience that you need, whether it's 4 years of experience or 2 years of experience, and how many of those years need to be in a leadership role. And up in that legend up on the left-hand side in that gray, it's very specific to this particular department. Mm-hmm. So next slide.
Can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
This would probably be hard to go back. If you fill in the gap, right, which I understand why you would want to do that, does that require the addition of a position, or would it indicate that maybe, well, this is a bad
example. It doesn't need a new position. We would need to create that position. And then, yes, you could grow. So maybe the accounting supervisor could move into that one, and then you would grow up. So not necessarily does it have to be a new body,
right,
but it needs to be a new position.
Right. So that person could move up, and then, but maybe their old position is not filled.
It could be, but you may need it based on maybe a span of control, right? You want, a certain number of employees that, you want reporting to you and to the other supervisor, so you can change a little bit of it. But visually for us, and, when we're looking at our class plan, it's kind of hard to, see. It's
It is very hard to see.
You have these, but at least here you can say, oh, well, that's a food for thought, right? That's kind of, we can look at this for the future.
No, I think visually it's really good. I just go back to, what I was recalling, and I'll look at my notes from what Matt said, but, we can't just add positions so there's not gaps, just to not have gaps. We have to, have the right number of people.
Right.
So if there's one higher, then maybe there's one less lower or something less different in a different department.
So let's go to the next slide. And so here is human resources, and it's, there's definitely probably a position needed here. And does it have to be a new body? No. It could just be one of those promotional opportunities. Mm-hmm. The highest it goes is human resource analyst. Maybe there needs to be a senior human resource analyst. Maybe there needs to be a human resources supervisor or something there, but it's something for us to look at to, if we wanted a better career path for the human resources department. We can spend our time looking at this one.
Mm-hmm.
Next slide. This one is administration, and it's kind of hard. It was thrown into administration because every department has support staff. So the one on the bottom goes from office assistant to senior office assistant to administrative tech to senior administrative tech, and then it can branch off. It goes to the left, there's management analyst one, a two, and a senior, and then on the right, there's executive assistant and then the executive assistant board secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there needs to be a senior executive assistant, or because there really isn't a career path there. But we can see we're doing pretty well on the support staff side, but maybe we need to look on the right a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Next slide. This is utility operations. Mike has done a fantastic job in doing this for, his group. We can see on the utility side on the left, he's really added those progressions. And so you could see that career path. And on the right side is field services. They have a one, a two, and a senior. Are they missing anything there? Maybe they're not, but at least it shows that it's a little bit different than on the utility side. But what you see the big gap here is between the director of operations and maintenance and your supervisors. So, and I'm pretty sure Mike has his plan, but that is a big gap. So there should be a manager or a superintendent or something, but that is definitely something to look at. Next slide. This is the Water Resources Department, and it's pretty good. It has conservation on the left, all the way to the sustainability manager. On the right, it has the planners going up to the director of water resources. So we're actually, for a career path, it looks pretty good here. And I think that was all the samples. Yeah. So we have, there's one of each, and the finance staff, so Darlene and Tanner, did a fantastic job at making, especially visually, and all the information is there.
Mm-hmm.
We have it for each of the type of departments, water systems, teacher, everything that we have one of these career paths for.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can visually look, and employees can go in and look. And it's just one simple thing to look at, because I don't know, they don't have to go through the class plan of is there a three or is there a senior here?
Yeah.
They can follow it and they can click on the link. They can go see what they need. But anyway, there was one of our strategic plan goals. And so, check.
Nice. Already.
Very good. Any comments online?
None at this time.
Okay. With that, great job.
Yeah, looks nice.
Okay. Well, we can adjourn.
Okay.
Item 14.
And I want to survey if Rochelle notices the clock.
Yeah, I looked up there and I'm like, is it really 8 o'clock? I'm not going to have time to, to go there. Like, surprise.
That's come up. You have a surprise party?
Well, no, I had mentioned the channel if we had time. I was.
Oh, the surprise. Get it. Yeah, it's come up in PL twice. And they're just like, eh, we're not going to change it. I guess
it gets changed in March.